Ahead on this Tuesday edition of Golf Today, 3 wins his last 5 starts, and Jon Rahm, he's getting a good hold on the top spot in the world. But now Rombo looking to do something he's never done before in his career. What are we talking about? The answer ahead in the show. While women's number one, Lydia Ko, in the midst of the same run, 3 wins in her last 5 worldwide starts, she's been playing some of her best golf in recent years, yet when asked if she feels like the world number one, she dropped a stunning response in her press conference. And new USGA president Fred Perpall will spend some time with us in the show. What mark does he want to make during his presidency? All this and more coming up on Golf Today as the show starts right now.
Golf Today.
It's a week where we honor the king. The stars align. The tour hosting its first designated tournament of the Florida Swing, and the game's top players trying to tame Bay Hill Club and Lodge in the annual event honoring Arnold Palmer, the Arnold Palmer Invitation. So with that, hello and welcome into this edition of Golf Today. I'm George Savarikas, sitting alongside Matt Adams for the next couple hours. We're going to hear from world number one Jon Rahm later in the show. He's speaking with the media right now in Orlando as we get ready for the Arnold Palmer Invitation. First thing that comes to mind, Matt.
The fact that we have a battle at the top of the game competitively. I think it's awesome when we have fields of this strength and they come together and we have the volatility that we have relative to world number one. Here we have Jon Rahm at top of the heap right now. Second, of course, Scottie Scheffler. And third is Rory McIlroy. And when you look at the average finish, I'll just go the last 5. Jon Rahm's average finish, 2.6. Scottie Scheffler's last 5 is 6.6. And Rory McIlroy trailing at 13.4, which is still a pretty solid performance. So I love the fact that we have this opportunity for what feels like a heavyweight bout whenever we get these guys together.
2 of the top 3 in the world have won at Bay Hill before. Jon Rahm, the unknown. This is just his second start at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Historically, Jon Rahm has had years where he just has skipped the Florida Swing or just played the Players. Now we're going to get to see him back-to-back weeks as the man in the top spot. We'll see if he can try and win for the first time in the Sunshine State going forward. Stacked field, like Matt mentioned, headlined by world number one Jon Rahm, who's got off to that sizzling start in 2023. 3 tour wins his last 5 starts since the calendar turn in 2023. His last win coming at Riviera Country Club in the Genesis Invitational. World number two Scottie Scheffler returns to Bay Hill to defend his title. Already has a W this season. That was at the WM Phoenix Open, where he went back-to-back. His last 7 PGA Tour starts, his worst finish has been 12th. 5 top 10s in that span, playing some consistently high-level golf. And Rory McIlroy rounds out the top 3, a winner at Bay Hill back in 2018. Rory picked up his first win of the season. That was in the fall at the CJ Cup at Congaree, still in search of his first victory in 2023. His last 2 starts in this calendar year, T32 at the WM Phoenix Open, T29 at the Genesis Invitational.
Would you take the 3 we just discussed, or would you take the field, Arnold Palmer Invitational? Let's look at some notables in the field. Of course, Jon Rahm, but there's Will Zalatoris, Max Homa, Justin Thomas, Patrick Cantlay, Colin Morikawa, Xander Schauffele, Victor Hovland. 44 of the top 50 players in the official World Golf Rankings are in the field. 19 of the 20 players in last year's PIP in the field. Let's hone in on world number one Jon Rahm again. Jon Rahm's recent success, 5 wins in his last 10 worldwide starts, again, top 10 in every worldwide event since September of 2022, 3 PGA Tour wins in 2023. He's played in the final group in his last 4 tour starts. And with more on Rahm, we welcome in Todd Lewis from Bay Hill Club and Lodge. Todd, how is it down there?
Well, it's a little windy and dry as it's going to be all week, and players are already busy on the range, as you can see behind me, getting ready for the Arnold Palmer Invitational, which is now one of the premier events, kind of as it always has been on the PGA Tour. 44 of the top 50 in the world in the field here. That is the strongest field, according to the official World Golf Ranking, since the Open at St. Andrews last year, and leading the way is world number one Jon Rahm, who most recently won the Genesis Invitational. How did he celebrate that win in Southern California? He flew back home to Scottsdale, Arizona, put his two kids to bed, and had dinner. So not a very exciting celebration for winning Tiger's event, but his game has been very exciting over the last few months. And it's interesting that John said last year he wasn't happy with the results of his game. And I asked him today, how would he compare the results and his swing now to where it was a year ago?
It's not like I was struggling technically. I wasn't struggling with my swing per se on how I wanted it to feel. It's just I wasn't getting the results, right? And it's very easy to get in your head and think that you need to be changing something, right? It really wasn't anything technical. But I still played decent. I mean, it was a bad year to some standards, but I still got a win, and I think I was close to 50% in top 10s. The only thing I've said many times is I wish I would have had a better performance in majors. It doesn't feel any different right now, I can tell you that. What it does feel better, my iron game does feel a little bit sharper, and wedge game is definitely a lot better than it was last year.
Since we're on the subject of comparisons, do you, in your career, compare runs that you're on to other parts of your career? And if so, where do you think you are right now?
I don't look at the numbers. There's experts for that. If I had to guess, statistically, I wouldn't say it's been my best driving, but every other part of my game is probably the best it's ever been. If that were to be my guess. Especially my wedges. I think my wedges, my accuracy and distance control has been significantly better than it's been in the past.
All right, let me ask you this. Do you feel more confident or as confident over a ball now than you have in your past?
I'm a pretty confident person regardless. So if there's ever a shift, it's minimal. Right, so maybe I'm a tick above the usual right now, obviously, because I've proven it to myself. But besides that, not much.
You come from winning at a challenging and historic golf course to now, yeah, which looks to be another challenging golf course here at Bay Hill. What do you expect from this golf course this week?
Well, I've already been told that the greens were already firm. I'm assuming the rough is high again, so I expect it to show its teeth. I expect the golf course to be tough and be a challenging week. But, you know, we need that every once in a while, right? It's good to play a difficult golf course like this where you have to show up and play good golf, period. There's no way to hide. Kind of like Torrey, that's why I like Torrey so much, and that's why I'm back here, right? That's the part that I enjoyed last year, even though it was a horrible week on the greens, Teeter Green, I thought it was, quote-unquote, fun to be a part of.
Final thing, you mentioned fun. You obviously play big events you have in the past years with a huge, strong feel. Mm-hmm. Now it's more consistent with these designated events.
Yes.
Is there joy in that, having that much power that you're battling consistently?
It's a lot of joy in that. I mean, it's what we all wanted, right? You've probably all heard the quote of, I want to be on the PGA Tour to play against the best. And for the first time, we're consistently playing against the best every single week, right? And that is the best measurement to see who's the best. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun and a lot of added motivation to it.
As John had time to take a breath and enjoy his recent accomplishments, he said, not really. He said, I'd love to kind of look back at what I've been doing recently, but he knows there's another great tournament right around the corner, so he has been keeping things kind of in a grind as normal for him. It's interesting. You look at his wins this year. He wins on golf courses that demand a lot of birdies. I'm talking about the Century Tournament of Champions and the American Express in the California Desert. He plays a much more difficult golf course at Riviera and plays well there. You could probably argue that this is going to be the toughest test that he's faced so far this year, although we're still early in the year. But his game travels very well. This is a ball strikers golf course where iron play is going to be very, very important, and he is very confident, guys, with how he's striking the ball, especially from the fairway.
How could you not be confident if you're John Rahm right now with the season he's had so far?
Yeah.
Already has three wins to this point, Matt. Sky's the limit, or what are you forecasting for the type of year we're going to see out of John Rahm?
A couple different things. For me, I have this curiosity if he will end up being the third player in the last 40 years in the PGA Tour to win eight or more times.
Wow.
The first two being Tiger Woods and Vijay Singh. And you look at it from the perspective of saying, yeah, the reaction of going, what? Wow, how can you even think that's possible?
Since post-2009, the highest we've seen on tour is five.
That's right. And if you look at the body of his work and the fact that I'll even go back to, you heard me open up and talk about his last five, his average finish is 2.6. If you go to his last 15, His average finish is 9.8. But when you compare him to the other heavyweights that we were talking about at the top, there's Jon Rahm, 5 wins his last 9 worldwide starts, September of 2022. Scottie Scheffler, 1 win his last 7 starts. Lowest finish was a tie for 12th at the Genesis Invitational. Then Rory McIlroy, 3 wins in his last 9 worldwide starts, including the 2022 Tour Championship, 7 top 10s. When you talk about that confidence that you're alluding to and why shouldn't he have that confidence, George, consider this. Strokes gained total, Jon Rahm, first. Greens and regulation percentage at 76%, first. Eagles per hole, first. Birdie average, first. Even when you go into his strokes gain off the tee, he's 7th. Approach to green, he's 6th. In putting, he's 9th. It reminds me of when Lee Trevino was quoted as saying that God doesn't give everything to every golfer. He was talking then in reference to the fact that Jack Nicklaus didn't have a good wedge game. When you're 9th in strokes gain putting, first in strokes gain total, and the fact that you are solid in approach to green and 7th off the tee, I mean, he's got the total package.
He's been a statistical darling for years in the sense that people said, once he puts it together, watch out, because you look at his game across the board and there hasn't been an area where he's been really deficient. 8 is a huge number. Last week on the Golf Today, I made the case for he's going to have 5 wins and a major. I think a big litmus test for him, he's never won in the state of Florida. He has 10 career PGA Tour victories. 7 have been Western time zone. You got 5 in California, 1 in Hawaii, 1 in Mexico. He's won twice in the Midwest,
yep.
The Memorial BMW Championship at Olympia, and a team event in Zurich. He hasn't played a lot in Florida. He's had a couple of years. He just skipped the Florida swing, like I mentioned, or just played in the Players. I believe this is his 6th career start in the traditional Florida swing events. The last player to win 4 times before the Masters, Scottie Scheffler won 4, slipping on the green jacket. Wasn't Vijay, wasn't Tiger, who had 8 and 9 win seasons. It was David Duval in 1999.
Wow.
If Jon Rahm can win for the first time in the state of Florida, then I'd say, okay, we got some smoke. He's already got 4 wins before Augusta. He could have a 6, 7, 8 win season. But we got to see what he
You're
does.
You're coming around to the way I'm thinking.
I think 8's still a huge number. I could see 5 to 6. But, I mean, he is playing head and shoulders. Like, I think he's going to be a number 1 with some potential separation. I said he's going to carry it
really
through the Masters. And I think when you rattle off those stats, that's where you see it. But we have so many guys who are capable of ripping off back-to-back wins or 3 wins in 4 starts. Scottie Scheffler did a year ago. Rory McIlroy has done it before in his career. Those top 3, though, have, I believe, a 1.2-point separation from Patrick Cantlay at 4. So those 3 guys are on a high plane, and Jon Rahm's even on a plane above Scottie and Rory McIlroy.
What's going to be his major that you're predicting?
I think he wins at Augusta. I think it's going to happen.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
See, I was thinking Hoylake. When you talk about Jon Rahm, one of the things interesting about how he plays is that he, and Todd Lewis alluded to it, he wins on all different kinds of venues. He's won in the desert on the west coast of the United States. He's won in the desert in the DP World Tour. He's won the Irish Open twice, which is a links style, obviously, because it was Port Stewart, and then he won at Lahinch.
But we haven't seen super grainy Bermuda. I mean, Zurich kind of counts, but not what you're seeing in Florida.
What we will see, though, this week is hard-running, fast golf course and rolling some 14 on those Tiff Eagle greens. So the question I have, when we're talking about these three, is with the conditions expected on Friday, expected to have the heavy gusting winds, is when the draw comes out.
You're big on the draw disparity.
If you are late early, I think you're going to have an advantage to early late, which, again, takes me back to some of the things that we see at the Open, because I think on Friday afternoon it's going to be very, very difficult conditions at Bay Hill.
You're really going 8.
I think the potential of it. Yes, I'm going to go with 8. Mark me on that. Save the video.
Lucky number 8. You know what? We're going to look at the Comcast Business Tour top 10. Why not round it out and make it an even top 10? Jon Rahm currently sits in the top spot. Just to remind viewers, the reason this is so important, since 2009, every player finished in the Comcast Business Tour top 10 has then played their way on to the Tour Championship.
All right, from number 1 in the men's game to number 1 player in the women's game. Lydia Ko headlines a strong field at this week's event in Singapore. We dive deeper into the current strength of the LPGA Tour when we come back.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
We're back on Golf Today. It was a life-changing Sunday for 2021 Epson Tour graduate Lilia Vu, who won the Honda LPGA Thailand for her first career victory on the LPGA Tour. Vu becomes the first Rolex first-time winner of the 2023 season, and with the $255,000 winner's check, surpasses the $1 million mark in career earnings. This week, the best in the women's game head to Sentosa Country Club in Singapore for the HSBC Women's World Championship. Coverage begins Wednesday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern right here on Golf Channel.
Let's take a look at the highest-ranked players in the field at the HSBC Women's World Championship. Pretty stacked bunch there. Lydia Ko, number one. Nelly Korda, two. Minji Lee, number three. Jin-Young Ko, your defending champion, at number five. With the class at the top of the women's game, the question posed to Lydia Ko earlier today in her press conference, do you feel like you're the number one player in the world?
To be honest, I don't even feel like the number one player. I play alongside the best female golfers, and I play with Nelly or like Gino or Jin-Young or Minji or Brooke or, and all of the players. You just play alongside them and you're like, wow, she's so good. And then there's a shot that I think Gino hit last week and she gave me goosebumps. It was like such an unbelievable shot. So I think you can never get too, I guess, cocky about like what rank player you are, because especially at the top, it is so tight and you know everyone's playing really well that you can't really say, hey, I'm gonna be there forever. I think, yes, like you should get the confidence and like believe in yourself when you're playing, but when I became number one for the first time, I'm still young, I'd like to think, but I was even younger and I felt like being number one meant that I had to be winning or like contending week in, week out, but that's not necessarily true. It's somebody that plays consistently, you know, throughout the season or through multiple seasons. So you know, everybody's gonna have the up and downs, but to kind of manage that and making sure those lows aren't super low and you don't get too high for the highs. And I think just having kind of gone through a little bit of those phases, I'm just able to accept it a lot better now.
So let's pose the question to you, Matt Adams. Should Lydia Ko feel like the world number one?
Yes, I believe she should feel like the world number one. I think what we're seeing in Lydia Ko is, at only 25 years old, a tremendous amount of maturity. She definitely strikes me as the most comfortable player in their own skin, probably in the game right now. The best she's played at this particular event was back in 2015 when she had a second place finish. But along the way, and I love the fact that you used the word class as you were throwing this piece, because she has class, she has poise that seems to walk hand in hand with her. Some years ago, she decided to adopt a yoga and meditation, and you can see the way it impacts her. This, she wants to stay level in terms of not getting too high or not getting too low. Again, as I mentioned, at only 25 years old, you think about what potential still lies in front of her. She was married in December. You know, she won just a couple of weeks ago. She's the reigning LPGA Tour Player of the Year. Now, I'm not saying that she's... I also believe, George, in fairness, that with Brooke Henderson already winning in Orlando this year, Jin-Young Ko playing last week and showing signs coming back from injury, that there's not going to be a battle at the top. But there's just something about Lydia Ko and the way that she carries herself and that quiet confidence, that quiet humility to me, that I think is going to bode very well. What's your reaction?
How long is she going to keep the top spot in the world then?
I think it's going to be a battle, just like on the men's side of the game, in fairness to that. I think it's going to waver back and forth, but I don't see her going far away from it, and I see her coming back.
It's interesting to hear Lydia Ko talk about how you don't have to contend every week and be perfect as world number one. That's what she's learned, yet her quote, off week last week, she finished T6. She's playing it
right
at such a high level. There's a bigger gap right now between Lydia Ko and Nelly Korda at 1-2 than there is from 2-3, Nelly Korda down to Minji Lee. But I remember at the end of 2021 into 22, I believe, sitting on this very desk on Golf Today, and we were saying, who's going to be world number one? Nelly Korda or Jin-Young Ko? Are they going to be the next great rivalry on the LPGA Tour? Injuries can happen. lack of form can happen. Like Nelly had the freak blood clot. Jin Young Ko got injured. I don't know with Lydia Ko. I think right now she is playing the best in the world. There has been such volatility in the women's game, much like the men's game, the past 2 to 3 years, that if you're hedging your bet, you would say there'll likely be a shakeup in the next couple months. But with how Lydia's playing, I could get where your lean is that if she is currently playing like the world number one, but odds are by the first major of the year, someone else is occupying the top spot.
I don't disagree with you at all. I love the way you phrase it. You say, could it be Nelly? Could it be Jin Young Ko? The answer is yes, it could be, because we just don't know. That's how good it is at the top of the game of both the men and the women's side of the game.
All right, before we head to break, let's get an update on the Epson Tour schedule. The road to the LPGA, here are the upcoming events, and they are in the Sunshine State. You see the Florida Natural Charity Classic March 3rd through 5th. Then it's the Carlisle, Arizona Women's Golf event a couple weeks after that. You see they had four events in that five-week stretch. They head back down to Tucson, Casino del Sol Golf Classic at Suelo Golf Club, designed by our colleague, Nota Begay.
Nice. I got a chance to see the Country Club of Winter Haven last week, and it is awesome. On the other side of the break, we're going to be joined by the newly elected president of the USGA, Fred Perpall, who will join as we discuss his goals as he enters his three-year term. Golf Today is back after this. Continuing on Golf Today, Matt Adams alongside of George Savarikas. Let's look back at some of the notable moments from the USGA Championships last year. In June, Minji Lee ran away with the title at the U.S. Women's Open at Pine Needles. With the victory came a $1.8 million check, the largest payout in the history of women's golf at the time. Just a couple of weeks later, Matt Fitzpatrick won his first major title at the 122nd U.S. Open at the Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. Fitzpatrick became the first Englishman to win the U.S. Open since Justin Rose won at Marion back in 2013.
How good was this? In August of last year, 17-year-old Saki Baba won the U.S. Women's Amateur at Chambers Bay, becoming just the second Japanese winner in the history of the event. And later that month, Texas A&M Sam Bennett, who we had on Golf Today recently, won the 122nd U.S. Amateur Championship, which was held at Ridgewood Country Club in New Jersey. He beat Georgia Southern's Ben Carr on the 36th hole. What a finale.
On Saturday, Fred Perpall of Dallas, Texas, was elected to serve as the 67th president of the USGA at the association's annual meeting in Napa, California. Perpall will serve a three-year term leading the USGA Executive Committee, the all-volunteer policymaking board that provides strategic insight and decision-making to the association's full-time staff. Perpall was first elected to the Executive Committee in 2019, and he has served on the Governance, Nominating, and Compensation Leadership Development Committees. In 2021, he became the chair of the USGA Championship Committee, which introduced the U.S. Adaptive Open during his tenure, along with the announcement of several USGA Championship anchor sites. He was appointed president-elect during last year's annual meeting. Perpall was first elected to the Executive Committee back in 2019, and he served on all of those different committees along the way, his ascension through to and eventually becoming the 2021 chair of the USGA Championship Committee, which introduced the U.S. Adaptive Open, as I mentioned, along the way. It is an absolute delight to welcome to the show Fred Perpall, the new president of the USGA. Fred, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. I guess, congratulations to it, but I guess the first thing to ask you would be this. What do you hope your goals and objectives will be under your presidency?
Well, George and Matt, thank you for having me here today. So good to be with you. Look, golf is in an unbelievable spot right now, and there's no question about that. Despite the tension in our professional game, recreational golf and amateur golf is thriving. You know, during COVID, 32% more people joined golf in the United States, and we have over 41 million people playing golf every week. And so that's, you know, an unbelievable accomplishment. So many of the new people that showed up are playing golf in non-traditional ways. You know, they're playing at, you know, off-site locations. They're playing a lot of virtual golf. 40% of that crew are people of color. 40% of that crew is women. And what I'm most excited about, for all these new people who have shown up, who are playing in non-traditional settings, is flinging the doors of the on-site traditional game open to them to let them know that they are absolutely welcome and wanted in this game. And so we at the USGA are so excited about the momentum in golf, and we want to be as collaborative and as unified as we can to absolutely welcome those folks in.
Fred, what's the transition period like as you get into the presidency? Do you look at prior terms and say, okay, these are the best practices I want to cherry pick from previous presidents? How do you leave your fingerprints on your tenure these next few years?
Well, you know, for me, the USGA has a history that spans almost 130 years. And so for us, I think, you know, it's important to look at this role over the long arc of time. As president, my goal is not to actually make all of the decisions, but to guide how the decisions get made, to work with Mike Wann and our management team. I think some of the best practices I've observed from presidents of the past, including my predecessor, Stu Francis, who's been an unbelievable mentor, is to be extremely caring about the team and all of, you know, the folks that we get to work with, to make sure that we are broadening our perspective, that we're listening well, and that we're doing all that we can to bring as many perspectives in. So if I can be a voice that is very, you know, diverse, broad, and inclusive, and draw in more, you know, perspective, then I think the USGA will be fine. We're clearly in a spot that we think is good. We have a great strategy led by our CEO, Mike Wann. And so for us, the key will be, can we actually get more stakeholders to come on board and to combine with us to do this good work?
Fred, you are an architect. You're the CEO of the Beck Group. And in your company bio, it says, quote, creative mind and innovative thinking with a highly energetic and communicative style, end quote. And I was just thinking about you interacting with Mike Wann and the energy level that both of you bring to your new respective roles. How much do you think that that's going to help with this style of communication and growing the game across the board?
Well, look, I think that leadership is situational, right? Like every time has called for different types of leadership. And we're at a place in our country right now where I think the public is demanding more transparency. They're demanding a highly communicative style so that you can actually explain your intent. I love Mike Wann's style. I mean, I'm going to have to increase my coffee intake to keep up with him. But I do think and I do hope what you will see is a USGA that is more committed to transparency, one that is more communicative, and one that is more collaborative. You know, that's certainly how I've built my career. And I think, you know, it's what we loved in Mike. And I hope that, you know, our two styles will mesh well. And I know we share the same values and we share the same goals for the game. And that's a game that is growing, that is thriving, and that is welcoming more people in. And so, you know, I hope we will do well together, and I feel pretty good about that.
Fred, you talk about welcoming more people in. It's nearly 130-year history of the USGA. You're the first Black president. What does that mean to you?
Wow. I mean, every time I hear that, it's very humbling, right? Like, we all stand on the trees that we didn't plant, and we all stand on the shoulders of others. And so for me, the great responsibility here is to make sure that we indicate to all those little boys and girls who may be people of color who are looking into this game that there's absolutely room for them in this game. I'm also mindful that I did not get here by myself, that, you know, all of my friends in golf, many of whom have been older than me, they've been white men, they've been people that have welcomed me into their life. Like, in this country, we talk way too much about what separates us and not enough about what unites us. Like, in golf, we're a community. We're a community of golfers. And when we decide to walk the fairways together, we're not only deciding to play our game together, we're deciding to play our lives together. And that is the potential that golf has. And so I hope for me, as a man of color, as a Black man, as a proud father and a proud son, will demonstrate to folks in my community and, you know, hopefully our whole community of golf, that everything gets better in your life when you decide to live your life in an inclusive way.
That's very inspiring, Fred. Thank you for that, too. I did want to ask you that it would seem that during your term of presidency that decisions will be made about the Distance Insight report. And in that golf community, as you're describing it, there are elements of insecurity about what exactly that will mean. How are you able to ensure that all voices will be heard in this discussion?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, it's baked into our process. You know, Matt and George, we've been pretty clear that we believe that there is an issue with how far the golf ball goes. We think our most venerable sites around the world deserve to still stand up to today's game. But we haven't been hasty in our approach. We've been listening. We've been including all voices. I myself have been in many meetings. Mike Wann, that's a big part of his job. So we're going to be patient. We're going to take in a lot of input. And we're going to be guided and measured in our approach so that we don't spring something on the game of golf that is not good for the game. We're also mindful that, you know, the average player may not be a part of what is producing the issues. And so we will continue to listen, and we're going to be very thoughtful. And I hope you will find that we're also very transparent. That's what our process calls for, and that's what we're committed to.
Fred, we've been looking forward to this conversation, and we're going to be seeing a lot of you at the myriad different USGA championships throughout this year. Looking forward to catching up down the road.
Thank you, guys, and thank you for having me on today.
All right. As Golf Today rolls on, he had his back against the wall in Puerto Rico last year, and Ryan Brehm delivered his first career PGA Tour victory to keep his card. We're going to hear from him as he's actually teeing up at Bay Hill this week next. Let's flash back to a year ago. Ryan Brehm needed at least a solo second to retain his PGA Tour card coming into the week at the Puerto Rico Open. He had a world ranking of 773, no career top tens in the PGA Tour. Final round, 67, got it done for what was his final start and a minor medical exemption and his first win on the PGA Tour. So with the win, he retained PGA Tour status with that two-year exemption, got a spot in last year's Players and the PGA Championship, jumped from 773rd in the world to inside the top 300, and was the first husband and wife caddy team to win on tour in nearly a decade. So with that, let's welcome in Ryan Brehm, defending champion in Puerto Rico, but you got a tee time in a different spot this week at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Let's flash back to memories from a year ago. As we go through those highlights, what comes to mind for you, Ryan?
Oh, last year in Puerto Rico, gosh, it seems like yesterday and 10 years ago all at once. A lot's happened since, and I mean, it's just probably the greatest week of my golfing career so far, without a doubt, and it was just amazing to be able to share that with my wife, Chelsea, on the bag.
Ryan, did it change your perspective at all after you broke through and now you'll forevermore be known as a winner on the PGA Tour?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think I knew what it really meant at the time. You know, we were just trying to plug away the best we could. Honestly, we were just trying to make the cut and make some money. And then it turned into a couple of good rounds, and then, you know, one thing led to another, and we on the back nine, we looked and we had a big lead and just kind of gutted it out. I can't really explain how it happened, but we were just in the moment, I guess.
Ryan, you look at this season, you're coming off your best finish last week, T14 at the Honda Classic. You've had some dry spells mixed in as well. Is there anything that you found last week inside the ropes that you feel like can carry on through this Florida swing?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it does feel good to be back in Florida. I really struggled on the West Coast, and it's nice to get on some green again and you know, feel the warmth a little bit. Last week was definitely a step in the right direction. It's been a long process of just trying to get more consistent on the golf course, and started to show some signs last week. And I was a lot better around the greens, and hopefully I can carry that into this week. This week's going to be a challenge, though. I mean, it's It's a very demanding golf course, and the weather report looks like we're going to have some elements.
Ryan, odd at all that you're a defending champion in an event, but then you're not actually going to be there to defend. It's a unique circumstance we rarely see on the PGA Tour, for good reason, though.
Yeah, I'm a little heartbroken, though, I'm not going to lie. I mean, we honestly, the year before last year, we finished tied for 11th, so I'm comfortable at the golf course, and I love the event, and I love being down there, but I'm certainly happy to be here too. It's a little bit it is a little bit strange, but I've never gotten to play at Bay Hill, and I'm excited to be here. It's kind of crazy. You can really feel Mr. Palmer's presence, even though, you know, he's been gone for a few years.
Very, very cool indeed, Ryan. Hey, you're a Michigan State guy. You come from football country. You're from the state of Michigan as well. I'm just curious about how that rearing and that experience and playing as you did in the Big Ten kind of prepared you for everything else that was to come in your life in golf, not to mention dealing with wins, which you will this week too.
Yeah, boy, we battled some elements in college golf, especially in the Big Ten. But, you know, I think I was ready for it then, growing up in Michigan, playing, you know, I think every Michigan golfer can understand that a 60 or a 50-degree day in the spring, you know, those golf clubs are coming out. It doesn't matter, you know, even if there's a little bit of snow on the golf course, we were just always excited to play. I think in terms of how it's prepared me, you know, for professional golf, yeah, I think you develop a little bit of a grit and determination when times get tough and the weather gets crappy, and you know, I think overall we along the way I kind of learned to keep a better attitude during crappy weather.
Ryan, got to sneak in one last question. You're from Traverse City originally. I think that's one of the best summer spots in the entire country, where height of the summer you could tee off at 6 p.m. and still get in around before it gets dark at, say, 9:30 or 10. Do you have a favorite course up in that area for the viewers at home? What's your spot?
Well, I'm a member at Lock and Heath Golf Club. I love it out there. The membership treats me incredibly well. But there's a lot of great golf in the area. You know, there's, I could go on and on. obviously on my collar, there's Boyne Golf Resorts. There's just some fantastic golf. I would encourage anybody to get up there and play, take a golf trip. You know, it's some of the nicest place, or it is one of the nicest places to be or visit, certainly when the weather's nice. Obviously, right now it might be difficult to get the golf clubs out. As I understand, you guys are battling some snow back home there in the studio.
Yeah, I'd say right now you'd probably need a snowmobile to get around some of the courses up by Traverse City. You're going to be dealing with some heat this week at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Ryan, best of luck, and hopefully we see another good finish like we saw last week at the Honda Classic. Thanks for the time.
I appreciate you guys having me on, and I'm looking forward to it.
So he was the breakthrough story last year at the Puerto Rico Open. I feel like Puerto Rico, or some of these additional events that we see on the PGA Tour schedule, you get a mix of a guy like Ryan, who's trying to break through for the first time, who's at a later stage of his career. You've seen like a Graham McDowell, who's trying to find it again, that was in Corrales. Or you can see a young guy who's on the ascent of his career trying to win for the first time. Is there a player that you're looking at where you think, okay, he could be primed for a big week?
For me, I'm going with Dylan Wu. He had a tie for seventh last year at the event. He's currently second in strokes gained over the course of his last 12 rounds, which shows current form for Dylan. He's coming off a tie for 10th place at the Honda Classic, and he's gained 6 strokes on the field in strokes gained tee to green during that stretch. So looking at all the combinations of things, and I think obviously current form is critically important when you're looking at something like this, then I always go back a year and I say, how does someone play in this event and at that course, and does it suit them? The combination of which tells me that Dylan Wu is in for a big week.
Can it go with the name that we had heard a lot about because he turned pro as a young teenager and then has had a bumpier journey to get to the PGA Tour? Akshay Bhatia We saw a lot of him last week because he had his shirt off, but he's
twice.
He's played three PGA Tour events so far this season, has made all three cuts, actually really showing some levels of consistency that we haven't seen out of young Akshay in his career. He was T49 last week. His best finish this season, T17 at the Butterfield Bermuda Championship, another event that's contested on an island. So far on the Korn Ferry Tour, his first two events in the Bahamas, T4, T7. That had a couple missed cuts. So right now he is top 25 on the Korn Ferry Tour money list. He seems to play well when we've had events either in the Bahamas or Bermuda. And I think his game's starting to mature. So I wouldn't be surprised if Akshay Bhatia is in contention this week.
I think that's a great pick. Aren't you heading down there? Aren't you hosting the coverage?
I will be on the call. Hopefully, weather permitting, we'll be on a flight heading to Puerto Rico later this week. And speaking of that coverage, you can catch live first round coverage of the Puerto Rico Open Thursday, 10 a.m. Eastern time, right here on Golf Channel. I'm joined by John Cook, Tripp Eisenhower, Johnson Wagner, and Billy Ray Brown. Golf Today continues after the short break.
Hour number two of Golf Today rolls on. Keith Mitchell is standing by. He joins us live next.
Golf Today.
Golf Today rolls on here into the second hour. Today, reminder, live coverage of the Arnold Palmer Invitational is coming your way Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. On Sunday, it was a thrilling finish, and we have that to look back on and more to talk about here today. George Savarikas alongside of Matt Adams. And, George, as we are now in hour number two, I'm curious what your thoughts are on the hour that eclipsed.
My thoughts going forward with the Arnold Palmer invitation, it always feels like a homecoming week for Golf Channel. Obviously, Arnold Palmer, co-founder of Golf Channel, Bay Hill Club and Lodge, his home course. Golf Channel spent two-plus decades, 25-plus years in Orlando. So I know for the people working the event this week, there are a lot of friends, family on hand at the API in Orlando, and it's a special week that you just see all the issues or points of connectivity between the Golf Channel and Bay Hill Club and Lodge.
Yeah, I thought when Ryan in hour number one, Rem, told us that you can feel the presence of Arnold Palmer there. As to how it impacts Golf Channel, it can't be understated that or overstated that the fact that without Arnold Palmer, Golf Channel wouldn't exist. That's the significance of it. Now, as I was mentioning to you, Sunday at the Honda Classic at PGA National, Chris Kirk hit a wedge to tap in range on the first hole of a playoff. Kirk would tap in for birdie, thus, to grab his first PGA Tour victory in nearly 8 years. The longest victory droughts broken on the PGA Tour in the current season are as follows. Chris Kirk at that Honda Classic, 7 years, 9 months, in 2 days. There you can see Mackenzie Hughes at the Sanderson Farms. 5 years, 10 months, and 11 days for him. Russell Henley, Keegan Bradley, and Justin Rose, accordingly. Keith Mitchell, he's got something to say about the same with the flashback of what he had here at the 2019 Honda Classic.
Remember in a playoff as well, another Georgia Bulldog getting it done from 15 feet out. His first win on the PGA Tour, holding off Brooks Koepka and Ricky Fowler. Let's get a little bio blast for Keith Mitchell. And he was an All-American during his time in Athens back in 2012. He's currently 45th in the world golf rankings, career best 44th. So we're basically seeing the top version right now of Keith Mitchell, who's inside the top 50 in the world golf rankings, three top 10s on the PGA Tour so far this season. And let's welcome in Keith Mitchell now. He has two top fives, your last three starts. Seems like, Keith, you're carrying a ton of momentum into the Arnold Palmer Invitational. What's been clicking with your game?
Honestly, to have two top fives, it's a lot of everything. So I'm very pleased to have my game in good place right now. But short game's been my weakness forever. So finally getting that, I feel like up to par the rest of my game has been has been the kicker the last couple weeks, but it's really going to have to show around this place. There's a lot of rough around these greens. It's going to depend on your lie, and there's a couple runoffs that you can actually feel like you can get some spin on the ball. But the way this place plays on the weekends, you're going to have to lean on it pretty tough.
Keith, you are first in total driving. You're fifth in strokes gained off the tee. I'm curious about that aspect and strength of your game, and if it goes all the way back to your dad, Jerry, introducing you to the game, that's always been an area that you can lean on.
It is. It's funny. My dad always had a really, really short backswing, and I used to give him a lot of grief for it. So I always had a really long, long swing. And so I guess around college and after college, my coach and I, Chan Reeves, tried to shorten it up and tighten it up a little bit. And it's helped my accuracy a ton. So just I've always hit it far, but at learning how to hit a fade and hitting a fade far was and shortening my backswing a little bit really kind of brought everything together.
Keith, you're the guy who's now kind of synonymous with wearing the visor on the PGA Tour. Your dad, Jerry's had a big impact on your career. He also was the one who introduced the idea of wearing a visor on the course. At what age did that stick? Because it's a harder look at, say, 8 or 10 years old to pull off than it is now that you're a PGA Tour winner.
It's funny. I think my mom found a picture of me and a good friend of mine, Charlie Killian, and we couldn't have been over the age of 4 years old, and we were both wearing visors. And so, I have pictures going back that long. It definitely, I use it in junior golf. We even got Georgia when I was at University of Georgia to make some visors with the Georgia logo on it. And so it's always been a part of my game, and glad to have it back and stronger than ever.
You know, when you talk about that, Keith, each of you guys out on the tour, you're your own business. You're your own brand in terms of what you represent. And the vibe that you represent, visor and all, I mean, you've got a look that reminds me of when Dickie Pride was prowling on the PGA Tour, Freddie Couples back some, 30 years or so, and even a little bit of Fuzzy Zeller. How cognizant are you of the vibe that you put off, the image that you project when you're on tour?
It's funny you ask. It all kind of started a couple years back. There's a guy named Sid Mashburn who has probably one of the greatest men's clothing stores around, and a friend of a friend kind of introduced me, and I went to his store and simply asked him, I was like, do you mind if I wear your clothes on the PGA Tour? And he's like, well, we've never done this before. And he's not, he doesn't have like a golf line, I should say. And so he kind of all was inspired by Sid and his team over there, and the way that they just, their attention to detail is kind of how we as professional golfers used our attention to detail to our game. And, he every inch, every centimeter, every millimeter, really, he puts in a time to his clothes. And so I got to give most of the credit to him and all the stuff that they do, because he kind of gave me that sort of vibe.
Keith, AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, you finished runner-up with Josh Allen. I want you to level with me here. You publicly shame Aaron Rodgers over his handicap. Then he disappears for a 3-day silent retreat to Oregon. Coincidence?
I think it was lucky for me that he was in that retreat when all that was going on, because that might have gotten some serious backlash from him. Even though he deserves it.
I was like, still waiting for you to throw that last jab in there. You couldn't let Aaron get away with it as a 10 handicap, winning the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, though it was shortened to 3 rounds for the Ams. You obviously like how you look on the PGA Tour. We had said your career best world ranking is 44th. You're 45th right now. Can you tell that this is the best version of Keith Mitchell that fans are getting to see? Like, what are you capable of? Where's the ceiling?
That's a good question. And, as competitors, as golfers, like, there is no end ever. I mean, you can look at guys like, Tiger's a perfect example. The guy's been through all his injuries and still out here grinding and trying to find it. And the guy doesn't have to do it anymore. And as a golfer and as a competitor, it's something that we always strive to be the best versions of ourselves, on the golf course. So I would like to think that, you know, if I can continue to do what I'm doing and do it better, then yes, I would love to think my world ranking would continue to climb and continue to contend in tournaments. And, you know, I always say I want process goals, and the process goals will create result goals, because if you just have result goals and that's all you're focused on, it's really hard to figure out a way to get to them. So I've definitely set some goals for myself, trying to accomplish them. And, you know, if I feel like I can do that, then hopefully the world ranking will continue to climb.
Keith, you mentioned before how difficult you think Bay Hill is going to be playing this week. You have had success in Florida in some pretty hard and windy conditions. Could you give us kind of a preview of what the field will be facing in the next few days?
It's funny you ask. I hit one of the best swings I've made in a while in 17 today, just a couple minutes ago. Pin was kind of back middle, and I hit a 5-iron as high and as soft as I could. It landed probably 20 feet short of the hole, kissed the flagstick, and still went about 10 to 15 feet by.
Ooh.
So, and it's only Tuesday. I mean, this golf course is going to play really, really spicy, and the wind's going to pick up on Saturday. I think it's going to be 30 miles an hour, even whether it's gust or sustained. But it's going to show its teeth this weekend. So the greens are always firm, they're always fast, and as soon as that wind and that dry air picks up, it can almost get out of control. I've never seen it out of control, but it can get right on the edge.
Fans seem to like carnage from time to time. What's it like for a pro inside the ropes this week?
It's a fun test, but you really have to stay patient, and you have to understand that you're going to make bogeys, and bogeys aren't that bad. A couple years back, I think I shot probably 4 over on the weekend and still finished inside the top 10 just because it's so tough. And this is a perfect example of that. The grass is on the greens still hasn't quite grown in, so it can get slippery. I'll never forget a couple of times you reach down to grab your ball out of the hole and your putter just slides across the green and, you know, lose your balance. So it's fun as a competitor, but it's also frustrating. It's a mental task. And if you can withstand it, then you know, you'll have a good week.
Got to throw one last question your way. All my buddies in Nashville say, oh, you got to get out to Sweetens Cove. That's all the hype that I hear. And I'm reading you had partnered with Peyton Manning and Andy Roddick on that project. How did that come about? And what's it been like now to see the reception it's gotten in golf circles?
It's great that place, you know, had an organic following. It was never like a marketing play. It found its kind of core group of golf fans in the right manner. And I'm just glad to be a part of like the real game of golf that people are starting to trend to. Just 9 holes, laid back, easy access. It's one of those great fun places that you truly appreciate the game of golf and what it is. And I think that golf should move that way into a more accessible, cheap and fun sort of feeling instead of, a lot of traditional golf can take 4.5-5 hours. And there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you're looking for. But to have places like Sweetens Cove and have the option is truly a great way that golf can continue to head. And, you know, like a place like the Butler Pitch and Putt where I did the Tito Shorty's Classic, right in downtown, just 9 holes, you know, no more than 100, 110 yards. I mean, those kind of days to me remind me why I got into the game of golf and not just the competitive side.
Love that, and shout it from the high heavens. Couldn't agree with you more. So it's a phenomenal. And I think that's where the game has to go. You need more of these fun 9 holes to get people involved. Hopefully, Keith, you have some fun at the API this week, and we'll see you on another leaderboard here in the Florida Swing. Thanks for the time.
Guys, yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's the last Tuesday in February here on Golf Today. Reminder, you can catch live first-round coverage of the Arnold Palmer Invitational presented by MasterCard Thursday, 2 o'clock Eastern, right here on Golf Channel. The Florida Swing with our additional event being the Puerto Rico Open this week. Then we head to the Players, March 9th through 12th. Valspar Championship closes out our run through the Sunshine State, March 16th. Through 19th, and this is a grueling stretch for the best in the game. You see how they played to par last year. This includes all major courses. Bay Hill Club and Lodge was 4th, PGA National 7th, TPC Sawgrass Stadium Course 12th. You had 3 of the top 12 most difficult courses last year on the PGA Tour in the Florida stretch. So for more on what the players are saying about this stretch of golf, we say hello to our Todd Lewis. Todd, are there any guys who are gearing up and ready and excited for the brutality of the Florida swing?
You know, actually, there are. A lot of the greater players want to come out and play tough golf courses. You look at last week, PGA National, home to the Honda Classic. That golf course has a lot of water. Wind usually blowing each and every day of competition. The wind's going to blow here this week, but this is a different setup. The fairways, you have to hit them. If you miss them, you got 4-inch rough to deal with. You got firm and fast green. So although this is not a major championship venue, it kind of feels like it's close to one. And because of that, this week, along with the rest of the Florida swing, will help prepare the better players for the championship season.
It's always good to get in prep on golf courses that are like the major golf courses. You know, I always feel like this place really tough. I was looking this morning at the course guide I get from Eduardo Molinari, and the average winning score, I think, over the last 5 years, maybe, it turns out it's like 7 under par. So, you know, that's, to me, is... I like it when I see that, you know. I hate the birdie fest, so I'm just not very good at those, I don't feel like. So, yeah, I like it, turning up to these events knowing that it's going to be a grind.
Why do you like them?
I have no idea. I think, you know, I've had success in them, and I think, you know, once you have something that you have success in, you probably, you know, you just get drawn to it, I guess. Probably the same goes for if you ask Rory, you know, why do you like shooting 10 under every week. I mean, same go for John Rahm, I guess. But yeah, for me, I don't know. I think my big thing is I feel like guys tend to just throw in the towel, I guess, and kind of give in. So it kind of, as the famous Brooks quote was, it's like, as he was reducing the field size, well, these guys aren't that good, and this guy's not that good, and 30 guys give up, and before you know it, there's only two guys you're playing against. So that's... I guess there's kind of a bit of that, but not to that extreme in my mind.
I like the fact that they're all tough golf courses. You're not going to go out and shoot 20 under par like a lot of times you have to. So it makes par, you know, important. So, which it falls into my game. You know, if I feel like I get my ball striking to where it's been, I have a good chance of playing well. And that's one thing I've been focusing on these last few days is just trying to hit the ball better. So, but no, it's exciting to be here and at this great event and at Arnold Palmer Invitational, so a lot of fun golf ahead of us.
Make you play really good golf. it's all execution out here. It's not, I wouldn't say there's too much plotting around the property. You really have to execute your shots and hit in the right spots.
You enjoy playing these difficult, challenging golf courses?
I think they wear you out. I've heard people in the past who've played here a lot, you know, when it gets windy and the greens get really firm and balls are plugging in bunkers, where they say, like, it feels like they've been out here for 3 weeks. But, you know, I played with a little bit of wind maybe 2 years ago, and it played very difficult. I remember shooting even par and moving up a lot of spots on the leaderboard. So it's all execution. You got to take what you can get sometimes.
All right, of course, it's Tuesday here of championship week at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, and players and caddies who are out there playing practice rounds right now fully understand that the golf course that they see today is not the golf course they are expecting to see on Saturday and Sunday, because the water will generally be turned off here and this place will dry out, and it, like I said, it will feel like a major championship venue. And on that thought, you look at 5 of the last 7 winners here at Bay Hill, all major champions. So the cream kind of rises to the top here at Bay Hill Club and Lodge, just as Mr. Palmer would want it. Guys?
Todd, thank you very much. Excellent work there at Bay Hill, and it certainly seems like a major championship perspective will help the golfers contend this week. Now, when Golf Today continues with the PGA Tour at Arnold Palmer's place, we're going to take some time to talk about the king, his life, his legacy, and his place in the game. That chat is just around the corner. Welcome back to Golf Today. This week, we celebrate the life and legacy of the king at the tournament, which bears his name. So many times through the years, Arnold Palmer would be greenside on that 18th hole waiting to shake the hand of the winner of the tournament that is his. This is the look at the statue of Arnold Palmer at Bay Hill Club and Lodge. So many will pause and have their pictures taken in the shadow of that great man. Earlier today, John Rahm was asked if he had ever had a chance to meet the king.
Did you ever have the opportunity to meet Arnold Palmer? And if so, what are your memories?
I was able to meet him. Last time I met him, I think it was in 2015. I think it was 2015 Palmer Cup, if I'm correct. We were at Rich Harvest Farms, and I got to meet him, speak a little bit to him. There's obviously a lot of people online. But I got the honor to go up on the podium as the European team representative and speak to Mr. Palmer and the audience about the Palmer Cup and basically thank him for everything he's done. And, you know, to see him there, and even at that point, to see him get a little bit emotional was very, very special. I didn't get to spend any time with him on the golf course or anything like that. I would have loved to, but yeah, that was the last time. And, you know, when you come to a place like this, even for somebody like me who loves the history of the game, to be able to see a lot of his quotes, see the part of history, how much of the history of the game he's a part of, and to even just see what this golf course was, see the pictures, the before and after, and the tournament he's created is really, really unique. And there's very little to say about him, right? Loved by many, admired by even more. And, you know, hopefully I get to have a career as good as his, but very challenging to do, especially with everything he did off the golf course.
I think part of what makes the legacy so special of Arnold Palmer is how many people have a memory that they draw on from an interaction or a friendship that may have developed. What's your fondest memory of the times that you overlapped with?
Well, just to your point about so many people have memories of Arnold Palmer, because he was willing to engage with people. He loved people. I think back on a story that I heard recently, this man that was put in charge of Arnold Palmer's security at a tournament. And he kept telling me that Arnold Palmer kept doing the exact things that any security detail would not want their person to do. And he would charge into the middle of the people and they would circle around him wanting more autographs than he had ink in his pen. Yet he'd get another pen and continue to sign away. And he later said to Mr. Palmer, "Sir, could you not charge into the people like that?" And Mr. Palmer answered him by saying, "What are you worried about? They love me." So the love was mutual both ways. He represented so many different things, George, to the game. He won 62 times, which is fifth all-time on the PGA Tour, seven times a major champion. He and Bob Drum created the concept of the modern Grand Slam in golf back in 1960 when he went global and arguably saved the Open from dipping down into realms of obscurity. But it's hard to define all the different ways that Arnold Palmer left his mark. The thing that leaves such an impression on me in retrospect is his humility, the way that he treated people with respect. I had a chance to ask him shortly before his passing what Arnold Palmer wanted to be remembered by and how.
Years and years from now, Mr. Palmer, what do you want the legacy of Arnold Palmer to be?
Well, I suppose just that I have made a contribution to the game to help make it a little better.
Isn't that moving? It's incredible. And it's just a piece. There's so much to Arnold Palmer. It's hard to try to encapsulate it. How would you try?
It would have to be the interview that I did with Mr. Palmer right before he passed. This was right after his 87th birthday back in 2016. It was a couple weeks later on the eve of the Ryder Cup. In which he had passed after just turning 87. And
what
I remember
cool shot.
Right before that picture, there was like five, six people around his cart. And it was the yearly sit down we would do as part of the event that was for charity, where you would have a group of golfers that would play around at Bay Hill and then fly up to Latrobe Country Club to see where he grew up playing the game, and said, "Hey, Mr. Palmer, George Savarikas, good to see you again." Well, I'm letting people talk. And then after 5 minutes, he turns to me and goes, "George, are you just going to let them sit around and BS all day, or do we have an interview to do?" And that was he still had that quick wit where you were all in on the joke, everyone started laughing, and then he kind of shuffled to the side and we did our interview. So it was neat to see he still had that same type of charisma till the day he died. And Frank Nabilo, our colleague, put it best. He said, "Every man dies. Every man or woman dies. Not everyone lives." And he had a life that was well-lived.
There's no doubt about that. You know, we spoke about it yesterday, and the modern game of golf, the PGA Tour as we know it, and the game at its highest competitive levels, simply wouldn't be what it is today if it were not for Arnold Palmer. He happened to be cast as the leading man at the exact time in the late 1950s that television discovered golf. And there he was with that smile, that it factor that you were just alluding to, that he very much had this ability to connect with people and those that would form the legions of Arnie's army after that. In every way, he was so unique that it would go without saying that we'll be hard-pressed to ever have another player that had the impact in the game of golf that Arnold Palmer had.
It's amazing the generations that he spanned and the connections that he had going back. What was it? I mean, Walter Hagen?
He
knew.
He was a pallbearer for Walter Hagen.
Walter Hagen won his first major in 1914, and then to Tiger Woods and some of these modern era players like John Rahm, who will carry that mantle going for another 10, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. And to think that John Rahm is only in his 20s, and he talked about getting the opportunity to meet the great man. And to this day, you will hear professionals talk. They still hear the voice of Arnold Palmer in their head when they're signing autographs. Because if your autograph was not legible, Mr. Palmer would let you know, because that's something as a sign of respect for the person that you're giving it to.